morning, everyone. My name is Christina Ventura de Perugia, and as you heard, I am a doctor of public health candidate. Officially, as of last Friday, I defended my proposal, so so I'm excited about that. So today, what I'm going to talk to you guys about is actually a really interesting faculty-student collaboration that at the time, track coordinator for the epidemiology program at CUNY, now the executive officer of the Doctor of Public Health program, and I did as a leadership project. So it was really great to have that introduction earlier of why leadership is important at Doctor of Public Health programs. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm just going to go over some of the background about CUNY and the School of Public Health to give you a little bit of context. We're a little different and how we've kind of come together, so I do want to give you a little bit of that context. And then I'm going to really go into the brainstorming, the interactive development, the pilot implementation, and given that it was small, what the possibilities, challenges, and next steps are for the project. So the City University of New York, CUNY, has an established commitment to public health education. And CEF has the CEF accredited public health degree programs. At Brooklyn College, the program itself was accredited since 2001. Lehman College in the Bronx, accredited since 2010, their specific program. And Hunter College's public health program that many are aware of has been accredited for a very long time as well. So the individual programs themselves have had an established commitment in and of itself. Now, the CUNY School of Public Health, the doctoral program within it, its inaugural class is actually, the program is quite new. The program actually started in 2007, and by the time I began in 2010, we had more than 95 students, and that continues to grow. We have about 125, 130 right now. In June of 2011, so all these different things happened. I'm not going to get into the politics too much. But in 2011, after an extensive process, CEF granted accreditation to the CUNY School of Public Health. So the CUNY School of Public Health, given that I explained we have the Doctor of Public Health program that's housed at the Graduate Center, that's the only institution in CUNY that's able to grant doctoral degrees, so we have one there, and then we have the three other programs that I mentioned before. The CUNY School of Public Health, one of the first things it wanted to do was bring everybody together, bring everything together, these different consortium campuses under the one School of Public Health umbrella. So again, like I said, Brooklyn College, Lehman, Hunter, and the CUNY Graduate Center. So the diverse public health programs across the three boroughs had a lot of different things. We had different faculty coming together, different specialized foci, so different programs. In Brooklyn, for instance, there's a general public health program. At Hunter, there was other specific nutrition focuses. And as I mentioned, too, in the doctoral program, we had different things as well. We have an environmental and occupational health major, epidemiology, community societies and health policy and management. So soon after accreditation, the need surfaced to standardize the approach to teaching key public health concepts under the greater CUNY School of Public Health umbrella. This came from faculty, but as doctoral students, we saw this as well. We saw this need, and I'm going to go into that from the student perspective, but exchanging with Dr. Nash, my student advisor for this, we both had similar concerns, and you'll see that shortly. For my particular interest, coming into it as an epidemiology major, this was my focus. Standardizing, I wanted to, and all of us wanted to kind of standardize the approach to teaching this as epidemiologic faculty, but this applied to everybody. It's very unique in that, and I'm sure a lot of programs are like this, there are undergraduate community health degrees that can be completed at CUNY. They have to take an epidemiology course. I've had the pleasure of actually teaching this to undergraduates. So they have to take an EPI course. All MPH students have to take an EPI course, and all doctoral students have to take an EPI course. So there was a real interest in making sure that, especially for the students that were only getting one little bit of EPI in one course, what are they learning, how are they learning it, and how can we make sure that no matter where they're taking the class, it's a similar approach. So for faculty, and I had the pleasure of sitting in on meetings and hearing a lot of this myself, one of the main things, as I just alluded to, how can we ensure that teaching of key epidemiologic concepts, and I'll go into a little bit of what key epi concepts mean, how can we ensure that this approach was similar across the CUNY School of Public Health campuses? And there are accreditation standards and such, so I'm not alluding to that as much as just making sure that if we all agree that selection bias means this, and we think it should be mentioned in EPI 1 and EPI 2, how can we make sure that no matter where they are, it's being approached in that method? In considering this very abstract concept of standardizing the teaching of concepts, in thinking about systems, the faculty were also thinking what systems could facilitate this process effectively and dynamically. And when I go towards the end, the dynamically is a really key important component, because I think all of us have been involved in programs and projects that are really great and have a lot of potential, but who's going to keep them going? Who's going to keep sustaining them? So the dynamic portion of this was really important. And we wanted to streamline implementation with minimal burden to busy faculty. Now, at the time when I was involved in this project, in the beginning, really intensively, I was an adjunct faculty. Now that I'm a full-time faculty member, I completely understand this even more so. Streamlining implementation is great if you can do things and make teaching more effective, but we all have busy loads, right? We all have to do administrative, teaching, and research responsibilities. So it's hard, even if you're passionate about something, to put something else on someone. So we really wanted to address, we want to do this, but we don't want to make it too taxing for faculty either. The School of Public Health students, and really I had the most exchanges with doctoral students, but as a professor, I did speak with master's level and undergraduate students as well, and a lot of these concerns came up a lot. We wanted to work with faculty to enhance the learning experience. We wanted to be involved, especially doctoral students and the EPI students, the cohort that I was in. We wanted to be more involved. We wanted to help. We wanted to teach. We wanted to be involved outside of the classroom. So whatever was going on, it was very exciting, especially and still is, in growing the School of Public Health. We wanted to be an integral part of it. And we also wanted, if you guys are familiar with some of the pedagogical literature, there's a lot of focus on using technology. But what realm of technology, what software, what platform? A lot of discussion on that. We just knew in the beginning we wanted to integrate technology better. At this stage, when we really started thinking about it, there wasn't iPads yet, not really too much, but now even more so, technology, making things mobile friendly, making things easier was essential. But we wanted to have things that helped us to prepare for our exams. We wanted things that we could go to rather than pulling out our textbooks on the shelf. What are things that can help us with preparing our proposals, preparing for our qualifying and comp exams, and even for the master's students for doing their capstone, their internships? They wanted something that could help them rather than going through all their PowerPoint slides and their text. So that was something that we all kind of saw very, very often, and we exchanged with the faculty on that. So for both the faculty and the students, an important criteria for us was to employ existing resources. It was going to be very hard for us, the students, to go to faculty and say, we have this great idea, but you have to pay thousands of dollars to do it. We wanted to use things that were already in place. And the faculty, of course, had that desire as well. It would have made implementation a lot easier, and rather than going through systems to try to do something new and possibly untested. We wanted to use technology, as I said. That would facilitate the dynamic portion of this, which I'll also discuss a little bit more in a bit. We wanted to create something easily and readily accessible. So in thinking about standardizing, there are Google Docs, there's a lot of different things that you can do, but if we had this one document that said, well, we all agree this is what selection bias means, and we all agree that this is what this means, it made a lot more sense for the students and the faculty for it to be something that was easily accessible, wasn't hard for us to get to, and readily for students and faculty alike. We had to think of what systems kind of overlapped in that way. And as I mentioned, we wanted to engage faculty and students in the process. That was something that would minimize that burden, as I mentioned, on faculty, but get students more involved. We wanted to have ownership in this program that was growing. So what we decided to do, and I know in the interest of time, I'm skipping over a lot. There was a lot of discussion of what systems were best, and I'm going to go into the fact that we decided to use Blackboard as our platform, but I know in other institutions that I've taught at, Angel is a platform, Moodle is a platform, and that's something that I'll talk about in the challenges, that this may be something you're very interested in, but it may be difficult to implement given the system challenges. So what we decided to do after a lot of discussion was to develop an interactive online glossary, standardized epidemiological terms using the Blackboard platform. Everyone at CUNY had access to Blackboard, and anyone could access it from a location or a mobile device. This was around the time when they actually had the Blackboard app that worked, so this made it really appealing for us. So it was very hard when I first started, when I said, oh, I have to post something for a class, but I couldn't get on the website on my phone. So now it's good, and it really was something where he said Blackboard is the way to go. So Dr. Nash and I, we began to develop it throughout 2012 and into 2013. And again, it's an extensive process because it was really coordinating the fact his responsibilities as an administrator and a faculty person and mine as a doctoral student. So I'm going to walk you through some of the screenshots of the glossary. And I'll also kind of take a step back. If there's anything that you want me to walk you through, I can even maybe give you access to it as a guest if you're interested. Just email me. I'm just going to give you an oversight now so you can visually see this. So when you log onto CUNY, I have to give access as an administrator for students and for faculty, but after you have access to it, this is how it's going to appear. We don't have it as a course. Other institutions that I've worked at sometimes put these groups into courses. Organizations were more static. The way CUNY works, they actually archive classes after 2 years. We never had to worry about with organizations. If you were part of it, if you had a CUNY login, that stuck. So that stayed. So you can see here under my organizations, I have that tab up in the top, but we had the glossary of epidemiological terms to be nice and easy. So I know I called it the CUNY Epidemiologic Glossary Pilot Project. We just wanted it to be something easy people could get to. Now, I kind of condensed the screenshot because it was hard to see what you had to see for the presentation, but after you click on it, if you're familiar with the Blackboard interface, you'll have a lot of different content areas you can click on the left. This will pop up as soon as you click on that organizational link. There are other things that you can click on, and I won't be able to go into too much. This is the highlight of the actual glossary. We decided to go with a wiki format. Just like Wikipedia, the way that you see it, it's no frills, but it's nice and simple where you can create an entry, you can edit it. I can, as an organizational leader, delete it. And you can also see the history. And that is actually a really interesting component of this because you can see what students have been involved, what faculty have been working on this. So that's actually a really cool component as well. And you can see here, print with comments. And I'm going to talk in a little bit about the comments portion of that. Now, no matter what entry you're on the glossary, all of the other definition entries are listed on the right. So no matter what you click on, you'll see everything alphabetical on your right. So it's also easy to kind of navigate through what do you need to do. And if you press Control F, well, I just want to know about cohort studies. You just put cohort, it'll bring you right to that link. The page contributors here, so I have, for me, this, I'm the only contributor for this specific page, but it's also cool to see anybody that's worked on that entry, it'll have faculty names and student names, and that publicizes the collaborative effort. There's a little notoriety for students to say, hey, I did that definition, that's kind of cool. So that's also an interesting component of this. Now, the definitions part was something that was one of the more complex parts of this project in trying to identify what definitions are we going to put out there. So we decided for the beginning portions of this to take from standard text. There are some other definitions that integrate literature, that use examples from different studies, but as a first attempt at this, we wanted to just really use, as this was a glossary, just really use different standard texts that are out there. And we have a references page too. Definitions for these certain terms are taken from these areas, so we do cite them as well. I had to cut that off for the screenshot. The page stats is interesting for us. It's kind of cool to see different things that are more popular than others. It's still in the pilot stages, so I know it doesn't seem like there's that many views, but certain things I could tell when you see later the results of the pilot, I could see which things my students, when they were studying for their exams, which things they clicked on and which things they didn't so much. So that was really helpful as a faculty person to see what things are accessing more. So in terms of the pilot, now we were working on this for a while. I just want to take a personal step back. I was pregnant for a lot of this, and I actually gave birth 2 days after my semester ended. That was really stressful. But we wanted to get some pilot data to get a sense of what the students felt about how this looked. We didn't want to go too far into it if this wasn't going to be very well received. This was going to be helpful for faculty, but we wanted students to use it. If students were going to take ownership of this, it had a better chance of being dynamic and being put forward regardless of the cohort of students long after I'm gone, long after the master's students are gone. So what we decided to do, my undergraduate EPI class in the spring of 2013, we decided I wanted to pilot it and said, okay, if you guys want to use this as a study aid, under the recommendation of Dr. Nash, which I thought was brilliant, he said, well, why don't you put two questions on a test for 1 point extra credit? Say, if you use this, what did you think of this? What was the definition that you really liked or the format that you liked? What was one that you thought could be better? So the extra credit thing actually was really excellent. It got them to want to be involved, of course. And the way that I structured the question, it was great. It was excellent. They actually had to use it to know. We also did in that, later that year, there was a graduate intro EPI class that was interesting, had master's and doctoral students in it, and we had them be a little more reflective. What are some definitions? How would you change them? So that was interesting as well. Now, these two pilots really showed us the possibilities of this, and there was a lot of qualitative stuff that we got from it, really. It helped me to get a sense of what things needed cleaning up, but overall, the majority said it was helpful and or easy to use. It was really positive feedback. I don't go too much into the negative feedback. The really only negative feedback was that they wanted it to be more expansive. They wanted more definitions. They wanted more info. So that was really great knowing, okay, good, we should go forward with this. And what's really interesting and a great possibility, even though those students, so the doctoral students that were in that EPI class in 2013, they still have access to this because it's on the organization part. It's never going to be archived as long as they have a CUNY ID. So that's really useful where that was just their first semester in the program. They can use it when they're doing their qualifying exam, their comp exam. So that's really useful for them as well. And faculty, as long as they're still a CUNY, also have access to it and can update definitions accordingly. There are a lot of challenges, and honestly, that's the one thing about this that makes it difficult. The growth of the glossary takes a substantial investment in time. And not even just posting. We may all have experienced this, but I know I have a lot. Blackboard can be fussy. Sometimes it doesn't work. I try to post something, and then it just gives me this error, access denied, even though I just worked on it for a half hour. So it does take a lot of investment in time, and that's very complicated for faculty and students. Some of the different things that I'll suggest in next steps address this, but not cohesively. The technology may become outdated. Right now, Blackboard is great. It may not be in a couple of years. It's great for us. It may not be great for you. A better avenue may become available, and how we're going to transition the hard work that we did is going to be complex. And another negative thing that students had said I didn't mention before, some really wanted to print it out. Some wanted to print everything out at once. Now, you can do that. The Dictionary of Epidemiology by Miguel Porta is printable. You can get a free PDF of that on Google. But this glossary wasn't easily printable. You can print if you saw with comments. So that's useful for one definition, but it was too tedious for them. So that was something that a couple students didn't want to use it because of that. Now, the next steps, of course, expand the glossary. That would be the ideal. Launching this to the whole CUNY School Public Health student body would be excellent. That's going to be time consuming to get people in, but we can work with IT to do that. And the bottom one is the biggest one. If we can kind of rotate faculty and a DPH student, maybe part of their leadership, as this was for me, my leadership project component, get credit for it, this will make sure that in managing it, it actually sustains itself and it's more dynamic. And that's it. So thank you for your time.
We have about 15 minutes for questions, so any questions? Comments?
Left. it's a great question, and it's something that we really.
So the question is that she said that she can understand how it can be really important for and good for students, particularly those who come from more privilege, to be able to look at the biases that they hold and to explore it, but that she's concerned about students who are traditionally parts of marginalized groups who are living this as their experience, and how do we keep them from being re-victimized, if I can paraphrase a little bit. That's a really, really good question, and it's something that we spent an awful lot of time thinking about. And when I go back to the, and I have to say, I sometimes hesitate to describe this lesson in this forum, because my fear is someone might pick it up and run with it and try to do it without thinking through all of these kinds of things. It takes a really good facilitator to be able to do that and to name that at the beginning, and to say, everyone in here has probably at some point in their lives felt victimized by stereotypes or bias. Some of us, that's our lived experience, and it's certainly not their responsibility to speak for a whole group or to educate the whole group. And so having a conversation about that at the beginning, one of the things that we have found is that it also creates a very safe and empowering place for people who have had that experience to talk about it and to share it and to let others know. It's empowering. I mean, that's one of the things also that we want to measure, but creating the space for people to say, yeah, this is me, this is my life, this is my family, this is what I live in every single day. And very often, they don't have that opportunity to do that. So it's creating that safe space for them, while also sort of creating the protection to make it safe. But that's definitely a risky piece. I agree. That's a great point. I don't think everyone should be doing this. So my background is in sexuality education, and one of the things I talk about all the time is you shouldn't be doing this if you're worried about it or concerned about it. It takes an awful lot of work on our own parts to be able to have these kinds of really tough conversations. But my concern is that because of that fear, we tend to avoid it. And so we don't use the kind of pedagogy that can be really effective. I mean, this is where they're going to be able to explore this and learn this. So that's the short answer, but I think it's how we do training for any kind of experiential education. We have to sort of do, first of all, go through these activities ourselves, have these conversations ourselves, have these conversations among our colleagues and our peers, and to practice. Stephanie, do you want to add something?
I was just going to add that part of it is that the facilitator has to prep a lot,
yeah,
and try to have a sense. So by doing it later in the semester, you often have a sense of who's in the room and what they're going to bring in the room and the types of comments that might happen, so that you have really, in a lot of cases, data. So, the comment that came up a lot about the recent Latino immigrants, so they're the most unhealthy. I mean, they get the most of that. There's data to show that that's simply not the case. And so being prepared to challenge the paradigm with facts often helps, because it'll at least make the students stop for a moment and reflect on how those are not matching up, how the data that we're presenting and what they mean, there's a mismatch, and then really allowing for those conversations to happen after that.
I would also suggest sort of, when I talk about having ground rules, is posting those ground rules, making them public, and having everyone buy into them so that if something's going on, you say, can we just take a step back? Let's look at our ground rules. Let's agree to disagree. Let's not do personal attacks, and let's assume goodwill. I mean, I have to say the assume goodwill piece is so critical to keep, like, reiterating. And so having those ground rules and keeping reminding students of that is really important.
As a member of the program teaching systematic self-reflection, I think there is a piece that could be added. I mean, I think the questions about empathy and how you feel as a victim or a victimizer and healing and being through that, and those are reflective questions. But there's another set of reflective questions that would be possible about, looking at that stuff on a newsprint and asking yourself, for what you put there, where did it come from? Where do I get these ideas from? Is it from data? Is it from the media? Is it from my family? And then thinking through the connection between that and personal experience and how what happens when these things are somehow collectively embedded in the community.
That's great. Thank you.
I love that, and that's so close to what I was thinking about. And I'm with a colleague of Chris Mira and Goldfarb, and the sort of general response was to the first question that you asked. I think was so well taken. As a department chair, what I experienced is exactly what Marion said, that if you're not having these lessons explicitly, they're going to follow up in other ways, sometimes which are really was disorienting to the professor. And so I think that having a plan in place to sort of address this systematically. And one of the things I know that my colleagues both use in the 90s too is a lot of one minute writing or really quick writing. So one of the questions that I have to really address is, what is race? How do I know? How do I know what race is? And then am I comfortable with what I think about it? And sometimes when they didn't select them anonymously, and very often it's like, I don't know how I know this. And so giving people that space to or to say like, oh yeah, I didn't just make this up myself, but I also want to say that at the federal report at ASCTH meeting yesterday, but this came about my mouth people. I think this is one of the areas that we as public health academics really need to figure out in classes that are heterogeneous, because also you don't want to turn off people who haven't thought through experience before but are somehow drawn to public health. And so how do we honor who everyone is in the class? I think we need more pedagogy training.
So I agree with you.
It depends.
I think it's the kind of activity that you could do towards the end. Like, if you're doing 6 to 8 hour training, that's very intensive. So over a semester, you can build much more cohesion and community in a group over one intensive day than it takes several weeks. Also, if you're
especially if you're sort of actively doing that. We've demonstrated this activity with professionals, and what I have found is that people self-protect. And so you can do this on a level that doesn't get as deep because people are being polite, but they sort of get it at a more intellectual level and they understand it. It's less in the gut level, but it still works to start the thought process going. But again, I think you need to do a lot of work, even in a one-day piece, like I would do it towards the end of the day, and having done a lot of group building work up to that point.
Yeah,